and Jim, he found a ratty old fiddle bow and a wooden leg. The straps was broke off it, but barring that, it was a good enough leg. Though it was too long for me, and not long enough for Jim, and we couldn't find the other one, though we hunted all around. And so, taking all around, we made a good haul. When we was ready to shove off, we was a quarter of a mile below the island, and it was pretty broad day. So I made Jim lay down in the canoe and cover up with the quilt, because if he set up, people could tell he was a nigger a good ways off. I paddled over to the Illinois shore and drifted down most a half a mile doing it. I crept up the dead water under the bank and had no accidents and didn't see nobody. We got home all safe. Chapter 10. After breakfast, I wanted to talk about the dead man and guess out how he come to be killed, but Jim didn't want to. He said it would fetch bad luck, and besides, he said, he might come and haunt us. He said a man that weren't buried was more likely to go a-haunting around than one that was planted and comfortable. That sounded pretty reasonable, so I didn't say no more. But I couldn't keep from studying over it and wishing I knowed who shot the man and what they'd done it for. We rummaged the clothes we'd got and found $8 in silver sewed up in the lining of an old blanket overcoat. Jim said he reckoned the people in that house stole the coat, because if they'd have knowed the money was there, they wouldn't have left it. I said I reckon they killed him, too, but Jim didn't want to talk about that. I says, "Now you think it's bad luck, but what did you say when I fetched in the snakeskin that I found on top of the ridge day before yesterday? You said it was the worst bad luck in the world to touch a snakeskin with my hands." "Well, here's your bad luck. We've raked in all this truck and $8 besides. Well, I wish we could have some bad luck like this every day, Jim."
"Never you mind, honey. Never you mind. Don't you get too pert. It's a-comin'. Mind I tell you, it's a-comin'."
It did come, too. It was a Tuesday that we had that talk. Well, after dinner Friday, we was laying around in the grass at the upper end of the ridge and got out of tobacco. I went to the cavern to get some and found a rattlesnake in there. I killed him and curled him up on the foot of Jim's blanket ever so natural, thinking there'd be some fun when Jim found him there. Well, by night, I forgot all about the snake, and when Jim flung himself down on the blanket while I struck a light, the snake's mate was there and bit him. He jumped up yelling, and the first thing the light showed was the varmint curled up and ready for another spring. I laid him out in a second with the stick, and Jim grabbed Pap's whiskey jug and begun to pour it down. He was barefooted, and the snake bit him right on the heel. That all comes of my being such a fool as to not remember that wherever you leave a dead snake, its mate always comes there and curls around it. Jim told me to chop off the snake's head and throw it away, and then skin the body and roast a piece of it. I'd done it, and he eat it, and said it would help cure him. He made me take off the rattles and tie them around his wrist, too. He said that would help. Then I slid out quiet and throwed the snakes clear away among the bushes, for I weren't going to let Jim find out it was all my fault, not if I could help it. Jim sucked and sucked at the jug, and now and then he got out of his head and pitched around and yelled, but every time he come to himself, he went to sucking at the jug again. His foot swelled up pretty big, and so did his leg, but by and by the drunk begun to come, and so I judged he was all right. But I'd druther been bit with a snake than Pap's whiskey. Jim was laid up for 4 days and nights. Then the swelling was all gone and he was around again. I made up my mind I wouldn't ever take a hold of a snake skin again with my hands, now that I see what had come of it. Jim said he reckoned I would believe him next time, and he said that handling a snake skin was such awful bad luck that maybe we hadn't got to the end of it yet. He said he'd druther see the new moon over his left shoulder as much as 1,000 times than take up a snakeskin in his hand. Well, I was getting to feel that way myself, though I've always reckoned that looking at the new moon over your left shoulder is one of the carelessest and foolishest things a body can do. Old Hank Bunker done it once and bragged about it, and in less than 2 years he got drunk and fell off of the shot tower and spread himself out so that he was just a kind of a layer, as you may say, and they slid him edgeways between 2 barn doors for a coffin and buried him so they say, but I didn't see it. Pap told me, but anyway, it all come of looking at the moon that way, like a fool. Well, the days went along, and the river went down between its banks again, and about the first thing we done was to bait one of the big hooks with a skinned rabbit and set it and catch a catfish that was as big as a man, being 6'2" long and weighed over 200 pounds. We couldn't handle him, of course. He would have flung us into Illinois. We just sat there and watched him rip and tear around till he drowned it. We found a brass button in his stomach and a round ball and lots of rubbish. We split the ball open with the hatchet, and there was a spool in it. Jim said he'd had it there a long time, to coat it over so and make a ball of it. It was as big a fish as ever catched in the Mississippi, I reckon. Jim said he had never seen a bigger one. He would have been worth a good deal over at the village. They peddle out such a fish as that by the pound in the market house there. Everybody buys some of him. His meat's as white as snow and makes a good fry. Next morning I said it was getting slow and dull, and I wanted to get a stirring up some way. I said I reckoned I would slip over the river and find out what was going on. Jim liked that notion, but he said I must go in the dark and look sharp. Then he studied it over and said, couldn't I put on some of them old things and dress up like a girl? That was a good notion, too. So we shortened up one of the calico gowns, and I turned up my trouser legs to my knees and got into it. Jim hitched it behind with the hooks, and it was a fair fit. I put on a sunbonnet and tied in under my chin, and then for a body to look in and see my face was like looking down a joint of a stovepipe. Jim said nobody would know me, even in the daytime, hardly. I practiced around all day to get the hang of things, and by, I could do pretty well in them. Only Jim said I didn't walk like a girl. And he said I must quit pulling up my gown to get in my breeches pocket. I took notice and done better. I started up the Illinois shore in the canoe just after dark. I started across to the town from a little below the ferry landing, and the drift of the current fetched me in at the bottom of the town. I tied up and started along the bank. There was a light burning in a little shanty that hadn't been lived in for a long time, and I wondered who had took up quarters there. I slipped up and peeped in at the window. There was a woman about 40 years old in there, knitting by a candle that was on a pond table. I didn't know her face. She was a stranger, for you couldn't start a face in that town that I didn't know. Now this was lucky, because I was weakening. I was getting afraid I had come. People might know my voice and find me out. But if this woman had been in such a little town 2 days, she could tell me all I wanted to know. So I knocked at the door and made up my mind I wouldn't forget I was a girl. Chapter 11. Come in, says the woman, and I did. She says, take a chair. I done it. She looked me all over with her little shiny eyes and says, what might your name be?
Sarah Williams.
Whereabouts do you live, in this neighborhood?
No'm, in Hookerville, 7 miles below. I've walked all the way and I'm all tired out.
Hungry too, I reckon. I'll find you something.
No'm, I ain't hungry. I was so hungry I had to stop 2 miles below here at a farm, so I ain't hungry no more. It's what makes me so late. My mother's down sick and out of money and everything, and I come to tell my Uncle Abner Moore. He lives at the upper end of the town, she says. I ain't ever been here before. Do you know him?
No, but I don't know everybody yet. I haven't lived here quite 2 weeks. It's a considerable ways to the upper end of town. You better stay here all night. Take off your bonnet.
No, I says. I'll rest a while, I reckon, and go on. I ain't afeard of the dark.
She said she wouldn't let me go by myself, but her husband would be in by and by, maybe in an hour and a half, and she'd send him along with me. Then she got to talking about her husband, and about her relations up the river, and her relations down the river, and about how much better off they used to was, and how they didn't know but they'd made a mistake coming to our town instead of letting well alone, and so on and so on, till I was afeard I had made a mistake coming to her to find out what was going on in the town. But by and by, she dropped on to Pap and the murder, and then I was pretty willing to let her clatter right along. She told about me and Tom Sawyer finding the $6,000, only she got it 10, and all about Pap and what a hard lot he was, and what a hard lot I was, and at last she got down to where I was murdered. I said,
who done it? We've heard considerable about these goings-on down in Hookerville. But we don't know who 'twas that killed Huck Finn. Well, I reckon there's a right smart chance of people here that'd like to know who killed him. Some thinks old Finn done it himself.
No, is that so?
Most everybody thought it at first. He'll never know how nigh he come to getting lynched. But before night, they changed around and judged it was done by a runaway nigger named Jim.
Why, he...
I stopped. I reckon I better keep still. She run on, and never noticed I had put in at all. The nigger run off the very night Huck Finn was killed. So there's a reward out for him, $300. And there's a reward out for old Finn, too, $200. You see, he come to town the morning after the murder and told about it, and was out with them on the ferry boat hunt and right away after he up and left. Before night, they wanted to lynch him, but he was gone, you see. Well, next day, they found out the nigger was gone. They found out he hadn't been seen since 10 o'clock the night the murder was done. So then they put it on him, you see, and while they was full of it, next day, back comes old Finn, and went boo-hooing to Judge Thatcher to get money to hunt for the nigger all over Illinois with. The judge gave him some, and that evening he got drunk and was around till after midnight with a couple of mighty hard-looking strangers, and then went off with them. Well, he ain't come back since, and they ain't looking for him back till this thing blows over a little. For people thinks now that he killed his boy and fixed things so folks would think robbers done it, and then he'd get Huck's money without having to bother a long time with a lawsuit. People do say he weren't any too good to do it. Oh, he's sly, I reckon. If he don't come back for a year, he'll be all right. You can't prove anything on him, you know. Everything will be quieted down then, and he'll walk into Huck's money as easy as nothing.
Yes, I reckon so, I don't see nothing in the way of it. Has everybody quit thinking the nigger done it?
Oh, no, not everybody. A good many thinks he done it. But they'll get the nigger pretty soon now, and maybe they can scare it out of him.
Well, why are they after him yet?
Well, you're innocent, ain't you? Does $300 lay around every day for people to pick up? Some folks think the nigger ain't far from here. I'm one of them. But I ain't talked it around.
A few days ago, I was talking with an old couple that lives next door in the log shanty, and they happened to say hardly anybody ever goes to that island over yonder that they call Jackson's Island. Don't anybody live there, says I?
No, nobody, says they.
I didn't say any more, but I done some thinking. I was pretty near certain I'd seen smoke over there about the head of the island a day or two before that. So I says to myself, like as not that nigger's hiding over there. Anyway, says I, it's worth the trouble to get the place a hunt. I ain't seen any smoke since, so I reckon maybe he's gone, if it was him. But husband's going over to see him and another man. He was gone up the river, but he got back today, and I told him as soon as he got here 2 hours ago. I had got so uneasy I couldn't sit still. I had to do something with my hands. So I took up a needle off the table and went to threading it. My hands shook, and I was making a bad job of it. When the woman stopped talking, I looked up, and she was looking at me pretty curious, and smiling a little. I put down the needle and thread and let on to be interested, and I was, too, and says, "Well, $300 is a power of money. I wish my mother could get it. Is your husband going over there tonight?"
"Oh, yes. He went uptown with the man I was telling you of to get a boat and see if they could borrow another gun. They'll go over after midnight."
"Couldn't they see better if they was to wait till daytime?"
"Yes, and couldn't the nigger see better, too? After midnight, he'll likely be asleep, and they can slip around through the woods and hunt up his campfire all the better for the dark, if he's got one."
"I didn't think of that."
The woman kept looking at me pretty curious, and I didn't feel a bit comfortable. Pretty soon she says,
"What did you say your name was, honey?"
Mary Williams?"
Somehow it didn't seem to me that I said it was Mary before, so I didn't look up. Seemed to me I said it was Sarah, so I felt sort of cornered, and I was afeard maybe I was looking it too. I wished the woman would say something more. The longer she sat still, the uneasier I was. But now she says,
"Honey, I thought you said it was Sarah when you first come in."
"Oh, yes'm, I did.
Sarah Mary Williams. Sarah's my first name. Some calls me Sarah, some calls me Mary.
Oh, that's the way of it?
Yes'm.
I was feeling better then, but I wished I was out of there anyway. I couldn't look up yet.
Well, the woman fell to talking about how hard times was, and how poor they had to live, and how the rats was as free as if they owned the place, and so forth and so on, and then it got easy again. She was right about the rats. You'd see one stick his nose out of a hole in the corner every little while. She said she had to have things handy to throw at them when she was alone, or they wouldn't give her no peace. She showed me a bar of lead, twisted up into a knot, and she said she was a good shot with it generally. But she'd wrenched her arm a day or two ago, and didn't know whether she could throw true now. But she watched for a chance, and directly she banged away at a rat, but she missed him wide and said, "Ouch!" It hurt her arm so. Then she told me to try for the next one. I wanted to be getting away before the old man got back, but of course I didn't let on. I got the thing, and the first rat that showed his nose I let drive, and if he'd have stayed where he was, he'd have been a tolerable sick rat. She said that was first rate, and she reckoned I would hive the next one. She went and got the lump of lead and fetched it back and brought along a hank of yarn, which she wanted me to help her with. I held up my two hands, and she put the hank over them and went on talking about her and her husband's matters. But she broke off to say, "Keep your eye on the rats. You better have the lead in your lap handy." So she dropped the lump into my lap just at that moment, and I clapped my legs together on it, and she went on talking. But only about a minute. Then she took off the hank and looked me straight in the face, but very pleasant, and says, "Come on now, what's your real name?"
What, Mum?
"What's your real name? Is it Bill, or Tom, or Bob, or what is it?"
I reckon I shook like a leaf, and I didn't know hardly what to do, but I says,
"Please to don't poke fun at a poor girl like me, Mum. If I'm in the way here, I'll..."
"No, you won't. Sit down and stay where you are. I ain't going to hurt you, and I ain't going to tell on you nuther. You just tell me your secret, and trust me. I'll keep it, and what's more, I'll help you. So'll my old man, if you want him to. You see, you're a runaway prentice, that's all. It ain't anything. There ain't any harm in it. You've been treated bad, and you made up your mind to cut. Bless you, child, I wouldn't tell on you. Tell me all about it now, that's a good boy." So I said it wouldn't be no use to try to play it any longer, and I would just make a clean breast and tell her everything. But she mustn't go back on her promise. Then I told her my father and mother was dead, and the law had bound me out to a mean old farmer in the country 30 mile back from the river. And he treated me so bad I couldn't stand it no longer. He went away to be gone a couple of days, and so I took my chance and stole some of his daughter's old clothes and cleared out, and I had been 3 nights coming the 30 miles. I traveled nights and hid daytimes and slept, and the bag of bread and meat I carried from home lasted me all the way, and I had a plenty. I said I believed my Uncle Abner Moore would take care of me, and so that was why I struck out for this town of Goshen.
"Goshen, child? This ain't Goshen. This is St. Petersburg. Goshen's 10 mile further up the river. Who told you this was Goshen?"
"Why, a man I met at daybreak this morning, just as I was going to turn into the woods for my regular sleep. He told me when the roads forked, I must take the right hand, and 5 mile would fetch me to Goshen."
"He was drunk, I reckon. He told you just exactly wrong."
"Well, he did act like he was drunk, but it ain't no matter now. I got to be moving along. I'll fetch Goshen before daylight."
"Hold on a minute. I'll put you up a snack to eat. You might want it."
So she put me up a snack and says, "Say, when a cow's laying down, which end of her gets up first? Answer up prompt now. Don't stop to study over it. Which end gets up first?"
"The hind end, Mum."
"Well, then a horse."
"The forward end, Mum."
"Which side of a tree does the most moss grow on?"
"North side."
"If 15 cows is browsing on a hillside, how many of them eats with their heads pointed the same direction?"
"The whole 15, Mum."
"Well, I reckon you have lived in the country. I thought maybe you was trying to hocus me again. What's your real name now?"
"George Peters, Mum."
"Well, Try to remember it, George. Don't forget and tell me it's Alexander before you go, and then go out by saying it's George Alexander when I catch you. And don't go about women in that old calico. You do a girl tolerable poor, but you might fool men, maybe. Bless you, child. When you set out to thread a needle, don't hold the thread still and fetch the needle up to it. Hold the needle still and poke the thread at it. That's the way a woman most always does, but a man always does the other way. And when you throw at a rat or anything, hitch yourself up a tiptoe and fetch your hand up over your head as awkward as you can, and miss your rat about 6 or 7 foot. Throw stiff arm from the shoulder like there was a pivot there for it to turn on, like a girl, not from the wrist and elbow with your arm out to one side like a boy. And mind you, when a girl tries to catch anything in her lap, she throws her knees apart. She don't clap them together the way you did when you catch the lump of lead. Why, I spotted you for a boy when you was threading the needle, and I contrived the other things just to make certain. Now trot along to your uncle, Sarah Mary Williams George Alexander Peters, and if you get into trouble, you send word to Mrs. Judith Loftus, which is me, and I'll do what I can to get you out of it. Keep the river road all the way, and next time you tramp, take shoes and socks with you. The river road's a rocky one, and your feet'll be in a condition when you get to Goshen, I reckon. I went up the bank about 50 yards, and then I doubled on my tracks and slipped back to where my canoe was, a good piece below the house. I jumped in and was off in a hurry. I went upstream far enough to make the head of the island, and then started across. I took off the sunbonnet, for I didn't want no blinders on then. When I was about the middle, I hear the clock begin to strike, so I stops and listens. The sound come faint over the water, but clear. 11. When I struck the head of the island, I never waited to blow, though I was most winded, but I shoved right into the timber where my old camp used to be and started a good fire there in a high and dry spot. Then I jumped in the canoe and dug out for our place, 1.5 miles below, as hard as I could go. I landed and slopped through the timber and up the ridge and into the cavern. There Jim laid, sound asleep on the ground. I roused him out and says, "Get up and hump yourself, Jim. There ain't a minute to lose. They're after us." Jim never asked no questions. He never said a word. But the way he worked for the next 30 minutes showed about how he was scared. By that time, everything we had in the world was on our raft, and she was ready to be shoved out from the willow cover where she was hid. We put out the campfire at the cavern the first thing, and didn't show a candle outside after that. I took the canoe out from shore a little piece and took a look, but if there was a boat around, I couldn't see it, for stars and shadows ain't good to see by. Then we got out the raft and slipped along down in the shade, past the foot of the island, dead still, never saying a word.
Chapter 12. It must have been close on to 1 o'clock when we got below the island at last, and the raft did seem to go mighty slow. If a boat was to come along, we was going to take to the canoe and break for the Illinois shore. And it was well a boat didn't come, for we had never thought to put the gun into the canoe, or a fishing line, or anything to eat. We was in rather too much of a sweat to think of so many things. It warn't good judgment to put everything on the raft. If the men went to the island, I just expect they found the campfire I built and watched it all night for Jim to come. Anyways, they stayed away from us, and if my building the fire never fooled them, it warn't no fault of mine. I played it as low down on them as I could. When the first streak of day begun to show, we tied up to a towhead in a big bend on the Illinois side and hacked off cottonwood branches with the hatchet and covered up the raft with them so she looked like there had been a cave-in in the bank there. A towhead is a sandbar that has cottonwoods on it as thick as harrow teeth. We had mountains on the Missouri shore and heavy timber on the Illinois side, and the channel was down the Missouri shore at that place, so we weren't afraid of anybody running across us. We laid there all day and watched the rafts and steamboats spin down the Missouri shore and upbound steamboats fight the big river in the middle. I told Jim all about the time I had jabbering with that woman, and Jim said she was a smart one, and if she was to start after us herself, she wouldn't sit down and watch a campfire. No, sir, she'd fetch a dog. Well, then, I said, why couldn't she tell her husband to fetch a dog? Jim said he bet she did think of it by the time the men was ready to start,
and he believed they must have gone uptown to get a dog, so they lost all that time. Or else we wouldn't be here on a towhead 16 or 17 miles below the village. No, indeedy. We would be in that same old town again. So I said I didn't care what was the reason they didn't get us, as long as they didn't. When it was beginning to come on dark, we poked our head out of the cottonwood thicket and looked up and down and across. Nothing in sight. So Jim took up some of the top planks of the raft and built a snug wigwam to get under in blazing weather and rainy, and to keep the things dry. Jim made a floor for the wigwam and raised it a foot or more above the level of the raft, so now the blankets and all the traps was out of reach of steamboat waves. Right in the middle of the wigwam, we made a layer of dirt about 5 or 6 inches deep with a frame around it for to hold it to its place. This was to build a fire on in sloppy weather or chilly. The wigwam would keep it from being seen. We made an extra steering oar, too, because one of the others might get broke on a snag or something. We fixed up a short forked stick to hang the old lantern on, because we must always light the lantern whenever we see a steamboat coming downstream to keep from getting run over. But we wouldn't have to light it for upstream boats unless we see we was in what they called a crossing, for the river was pretty high yet, very low banks being still a little under water, so upbound boats didn't always run the channel, but hunted easy water. This second night, we run between 7 and 8 hours, with a current that was making over 4 mile an hour. We catched fish and talked, and we took a swim now and then to keep off sleepiness. It was kind of solemn, drifting down the big still river, laying on our backs looking up at the stars, and we didn't ever feel like talking loud, and it weren't often that we laughed, only a little kind of a low chuckle. We had mighty good weather, as a general thing, and nothing ever happened to us at all, that night, nor the next, nor the next. Every night we passed towns, some of them away up on black hillsides, nothing but just a shiny bed of lights, not a house could you see. The fifth night we passed St. Louis, and it was like the whole world lit up. In St. Petersburg, they used to say there was 20 or 30,000 people in St. Louis, but I never believed it till I see that wonderful spread of lights at 2 o'clock that still night. There weren't a sound there. Everybody was asleep. Every night now, I used to slip ashore, towards 10 o'clock, at some little village, and buy 10 or 15 cents worth of meal or bacon or other stuff to eat. And sometimes I lifted a chicken that weren't roosting comfortable and took him along. Pap always said, take a chicken when you get a chance, because if you don't want him yourself, you can easy find somebody that does, and a good deed ain't ever forgot. I never see Pap when he didn't want the chicken himself, but that is what he used to say anyway. Mornings, before daylight, I slipped into cornfields and borrowed a watermelon or a mushmelon or a pumpkin or some new corn or things of that kind. Pap always said it weren't no harm to borrow things if you was meaning to pay them back sometime. But the widow said it weren't anything but a soft name for stealing, and no decent body would do it. Jim said he reckoned the widow was partly right and Pap was partly right. So the best way would be for us to pick out 2 or 3 things on the list and say we wouldn't borrow them any more. Then he reckoned it wouldn't be no harm to borrow the others. So we talked it over all one night, drifting along down the river, trying to make up our minds whether to drop the watermelons, or the cantaloupes, or the mushmelons, or what. But towards daylight we got it all settled satisfactory, and concluded to drop crabapples and persimmons. We weren't feeling just right before that, but it was all comfortable now. I was glad the way it come out, too, because crabapples ain't ever good, and the persimmons wouldn't be ripe for 2 or 3 months yet. We shot a waterfowl now and then, that got up too early in the morning or didn't go to bed early enough in the evening. Take it all around, we lived pretty high. The fifth night below St. Louis, we had a big storm after midnight, with a power of thunder and lightning, and the rain poured down in a solid sheet. We stayed in the wigwam and let the raft take care of itself. When the lightning glared out, we could see a big straight river ahead, and high rocky bluffs on both sides. By and by, says I, "Hello, Jim, look yonder." It was a steamboat that had killed herself on a rock. We was drifting straight down on her. The lightning showed her very distinct. She was leaning over with part of her upper deck above water, and you could see every little chimbley guy clean and clear, and a chair by the big bell, with an old slouch hat hanging on the back of it when the flashes come. Well, it being away in the night, and stormy,
and all so mysterious-like, I felt just the way any other boy would have felt when I see that wreck laying there so mournful and lonesome in the middle of the river. I wanted to get aboard of her and slink around a little and see what there was there. So I says, "Let's land on her, Jim." But Jim was dead against it at first. He says,
"I don't want to go fooling along of no wreck. We's doing blame well, and we better let blame well alone, as the good book says. Like as not there's a watchman on that wreck."
"Watchman, your grandmother," I says. "There ain't nothing to watch but the Texas and the pilot house. And do you reckon anybody's going to risk his life for a Texas and a pilot house such a night as this, when it's likely to break up and wash off down the river any minute?"
Jim couldn't say nothing to that, so he didn't try.
"And besides," I says, "we might borrow something worth having out of the captain's stateroom. Cigars, I bet you, and cost 5 cents apiece, solid cash. Steamboat captains is always rich and get $60 a month, and they don't care a cent what a thing costs, you know, long as they want it. Stick a candle in your pocket. I can't rest, Jim, till we give her a rummaging."
"Do you reckon Tom Sawyer would ever go by this thing?"
"Not for pie, he wouldn't. He'd call it an adventure. That's what he'd call it, and he'd land on that wreck if it was his last act. And wouldn't he throw style into it? Wouldn't he spread himself? Nor nothing? Why, you'd think it was Christopher Columbus discovering Kingdom Come. I wish Tom Sawyer was here." Jim, he grumbled a little, but give in. He said we mustn't talk any more than we could help, and then talk mighty low. The lightning showed us the wreck again just in time, and we fetched the starboard derrick and made fast there. The deck was high out here. We went sneaking down the slope of it to labbord in the dark, towards the Texas, feeling our way slow with our feet and spreading our hands out to fend off the guys, for it was so dark we couldn't see no sign of them. Pretty soon we struck the forward end of the skylight and clumb on to it, and the next step fetched us in front of the captain's door, which was open, and by Jiminy, away down through the Texas hall we see a light, and all in the same second we seemed to hear low voices in yonder. Jim whispered and said he was feeling powerful sick, and told me to come along. I says, "All right," and was going to start for the raft, but just then I heard a voice wail out and say, "Oh, please don't, boys. I swear I won't ever tell." Another voice said pretty loud, "It's a lie, Jim Turner. You've acted this way before. You always want more than your share of the truck, and you've always got it, too, because you've swore if you didn't, you'd tell. But this time, you've said it just one time too many. You're the meanest, treacherousest hound in this country." By this time, Jim was gone for the raft. I was just a-bilin' with curiosity, and I says to myself, "Tom Sawyer wouldn't back out now, and so I won't either. I'm a-goin' to see what's going on here." So I dropped on my hands and knees in the little passage and crept aft into the dark, till there weren't but about one stateroom betwixt me and the cross-hall of the Texas. Then in there I see a man stretched on the floor and tied hand and foot, and two men standing over him, and one of them had a dim lantern in his hand, and the other one had a pistol. This one kept pointing the pistol at the man's head on the floor and saying, "I'd like to, and I order too, a mean skunk." The man on the floor would shrivel up and say, "Oh, please don't, Bill. I ain't ever going to tell." And every time he said that, the man with the lantern would laugh and say, "'Deed, you ain't. You never said no truer thing than that, you bet you." And once he said, "Hear him beg. And yet, if we hadn't got the best of him and tied him, he'd have killed us both. And what for? Just for nothing. Just because we stood on our rights, that's what's for. But I lay you ain't a-goin' to threaten nobody any more, Jim Turner. Put up that pistol, Bill." Bill says, "I don't want to, Jake Packard. I'm for killin' him. And didn't he kill old Hatfield just the same way? And don't he deserve it? But I don't want him killed, and I've got my reasons for it." "Bless your heart for them words, Jake Packard. I'll never forget you, long's I live," says the man on the floor, sort of blubberin'. Packard didn't take no notice of that, but hung up his lantern on a nail and started towards where I was, there in the dark, and motioned Bill to come. I crawfished as fast as I could, about 2 yards, but the boat slanted so that I couldn't make very good time.
So to keep from getting run over and catched, I crawled into a stateroom on the upper side. The man come a-pawing along in the dark, and when Packard got to my stateroom, he says, "Here, come in here." And in he come, and Bill after him. But before they got in, I was up in the upper berth, cornered, and sorry I come. Then they stood there with their hands on the ledge of the berth and talked. I couldn't see them, but I could tell where they was by the whiskey they'd been having. I was glad I didn't drink whiskey, but it wouldn't made much difference anyway, because most of the time they couldn't have treed me because I didn't breathe. I was too scared, and besides, a body couldn't breathe and hear such talk. They talked low and earnest. Bill wanted to kill Turner. He says, "He said he'll tell, and he will. If we was to give both our shares to him now, it wouldn't make no difference after the row and the way we've served him. Sure's you're born, he'll turn state's evidence. Now you hear me. I'm for putting him out of his troubles."
"So am I," says Packard, very quiet.
"Blame it. I'd sort of begun to think you wasn't. Well, then, that's all right. Let's go and do it." "Hold on a minute. I ain't had my say yet. You listen to me. Shooting's good, but there's quieter ways if the thing's got to be done. But what I say is this. It ain't good sense to go courting around after a halter. If you can get at what you're up to in some way that's just as good and at the same time don't bring you into no risks. Ain't that so?"
"You bet it is. But how you going to manage it this time?"
"Well, my idea is this. We'll rustle around and gither up whatever pickings we've overlooked in the staterooms and shove for shore and hide the truck. Then we'll wait. Now I say it ain't a-going to be more'n 2 hours before this wrack breaks up and washes off down the river. See? He'll be drowned and won't have nobody to blame for it but his own self. I reckon that's a considerable sight better than killing of him. I'm unfavorable to killing a man as long as you can get around it. It ain't good sense. It ain't good morals. Ain't I right?"
"Yes. I reckon you are. But suppose she don't break up and wash off?"
"Well, we can wait the 2 hours anyway and see, can't we?"
"All right, then. Come along."
So they started, and I lit out, all in a cold sweat, and scrambled forward. It was dark as pitch there, but I said in a kind of coarse whisper,
"Jim!"
And he answered up, right at my elbow, with a sort of a moan, and I says,
"Quick, Jim! It ain't no time for fooling around and moaning. There's a gang of murderers in yonder, and if we don't hunt up their boat and set her drifting down the river so these fellows can't get away from the wreck, there's one of them going to be in a bad fix. But if we find their boat, we can put all of them in a bad fix, for the sheriff'll get 'em. Quick, hurry! I'll hunt the labbord side. You hunt the stabbard. You start at the raft and—"
"Oh, my lordy, lordy, raft! There ain't no raft no more! She done broke loose and gone, and here we is."
Chapter 13. Well, I catch my breath and most fainted. Shut up on a wreck with such a gang as that. But it weren't no time to be sentimentering. We'd got to find that boat now. Had to have it for ourselves. So we went a-quaking and a-shaking down the starboard side, and slow work it was, too. Seemed a week before we got to the stern. No sign of a boat. Jim said he didn't believe he could go any further. So scared he hadn't hardly any strength left, he said. But I said, "Come on, if we get left on this wreck, we are in a fix, sure." So on we prowled again. We struck for the stern of the Texas and found it, and then scrabbled along forwards on the skylight, hanging on from shutter to shutter, for the edge of the skylight was in the water. When we got pretty close to the cross hall door, there was the skiff, sure enough. I could just barely see her. I felt ever so thankful. In another second, I would have been aboard of her, but just then the door opened. One of the men stuck his head out, only about a couple of foot from me, and I thought I was gone. But he jerked it in again and says,
"Heave that blame lantern out of sight, Bill."
He flung a bag of something into the boat, and then got in himself and sat down. It was Packard. Then Bill, he come out and got in. Packard says in a low voice, "Already? Shove off." I couldn't hardly hang on to the shutters, I was so weak. But Bill says,
"Hold on. Did you go through 'em?"
"No, didn't you?"
"No.
so he's got his share of the cash yet.
Well, then, come along. No use to take truck and leave money.
Say, won't he suspicion what we're up to?
Maybe he won't, but we gotta have it anyway. Come along.
So they got out and went in. The door slammed too, because it was on the careen side, and in a half a second I was in the boat, and Jim come a-tumbling after me. I out with my knife and cut the rope, and away we went. We didn't touch an oar, and we didn't speak nor whisper, nor hardly even breathe. We went gliding swift along, dead silent, past the tip of the paddle box, and past the stern. Then in a second or two more, we was 100 yards below the wreck, and the darkness soaked her up, every last sign of her, and we was safe and noted. When we was 300 or 400 yards downstream, we see the lantern show like a little spark at the Texas door for a second, and we knowed by that the rascals had missed their boat, and was beginning to understand that they was in just as much trouble now as Jim Turner was. Then Jim manned the oars, and we took out after our raft. Now was the first time that I begun to worry about the men. I reckon I hadn't had time to before. I begun to think how dreadful it was, even for murderers, to be in such a fix. I says to myself, there ain't no telling but I might come to be a murderer myself yet, and then how would I like it? So says I to Jim, the first light we see, we'll land 100 yards below it or above it, in a place where it's a good hiding place for you and the skiff, and then I'll go and fix up some kind of a yarn, and get somebody to go for that gang and get them out of their scrape, so they can be hung when their time comes. But that idea was a failure, for pretty soon it begun to storm again, and this time worse than ever. The rain poured down and never a light showed, everybody in bed, I reckon. We boomed along down the river watching for lights and watching for our raft. After a long time the rain let up, but the clouds stayed and the lightning kept whimpering, and by a flash showed us a black thing ahead, floating, and we made for it. It was the raft, and mighty glad was we to get aboard of it again. We seen a light now away down to the right on shore, so I said I would go for it. The skiff was half full of plunder which that gang had stole there on the wreck. We hustled it onto the raft in a pile, and I told Jim to float along down and show a light when he judged that he had gone about 2 mile, and keep it burning till I come. Then I manned my oars and shoved for the light. As I got down towards it, 3 or 4 more showed, up on a hillside. It was a village. I closed in above the shore light and laid on my oars and floated. As I went by, I see it was a lantern hanging on the jackstaff of a double-hull ferry boat. I skimmed around for the watchman, a-wondering whereabouts he slept, and by I found him roosting on the bits forward, with his head down between his knees. I give his shoulder 2 or 3 little shoves and begun to cry. He stirred up in a kind of startlish way. When he see it was only me, he took a good gap and stretch, and then he says, "Hello, what's up? Don't cry, bub. What's the trouble?" I says, "Pap, and ma'am, and sis, and..." Then I broke down. He says, "Oh, dang it now, don't take on so. We all has to have our troubles, and this'll come out all right. What's the matter with him?"
There, are you the watchman of the boat?"
"Yes," he says, kind of pretty well satisfied-like. "I'm the captain, and the owner, and the mate, and the pilot, and watchman, and head deckhand, and sometimes I'm the freight and passengers. I ain't as rich as old Jim Hornback, and I can't be so blame generous and good to Tom, Dick, and Harry as what he is, and slam around money the way he does. But I've told him many a time I wouldn't trade places with him. For, says I, a sailor's life's the life for me, and I'm denied if I'd live 2 mile out of town where there ain't nothing ever going on, not for all his spondalicks and as much more on top of it, says I." I broke in and says,
"They're in an awful peck of trouble, and..."
"Who is?"
"Why, Pap, and Ma'am, and Sis, and Miss Hooker, and if you take your ferry boat and go up there..."
"Up where? Where are they?"
"On the wreck."
"What wreck?"
"Why, there ain't but one."
"What, you don't mean the Walter Scott?"
"Yes. Good land, what are they doing there, for gracious sake?" "Well, they didn't go there a purpose."
"I bet they didn't. Why, great goodness, there ain't no chance for 'em if they don't get off mighty quick.
Why, how in the nation did they ever get into such a scrape?
Well, easy enough. Miss Hooker was a-visitin' up there to the town.
Yes, Booth's Landing. Go on.
She was a-visitin' there at Booth's Landing, and just in the edge of the evening, she started over with her nigger woman and the horse ferry to stay all night at her friend's house, Miss What You May Call Her, I disremember her name, and they lost their steering oar and swung around and went a-floatin' down stern first, about 2 mile, and saddlebagged on the wreck. And the ferryman and the nigger woman and the horses was all lost. But Miss Hooker, she made a grab and got aboard the wreck. Well, about an hour after dark, we come along down in our trading scow, and it was so dark we didn't notice the wreck till we was right on it. And so we saddlebags, but all of us was saved, but Bill Whipple, and oh, he was the best creeter. I most wished it had been me, I do. My George, it's the beatenest thing I ever struck. And then what did you all do? Well, we hollered and took on, but it's so wide there, we couldn't make nobody hear. So Pap said somebody got to get ashore and get help somehow. I was the only one that could swim, so I made a dash for it. And Miss Hooker, she said if I didn't strike help sooner, come here and hunt up her uncle, and he'd fix the thing. I made the land about a mile below and been fooling along ever since, trying to get people to do something, but they said, well, what in such a night and such a current? There ain't no sense in it. Go for the steam ferry. Now, if you'll go and...
By Jackson, I'd like to. And blame it, I don't know, but I will.
But who in the ding nations are going to pay for it?
Do you reckon you'll pap?
Why, that's all right. Miss Hooker, she told me particular that her Uncle Hornback...
Great guns! Is he her uncle? Looky here, you break for that light over yonder way and turn out west when you get there, and about a quarter of a mile out, you'll come to the tavern. Tell him to dart you out to Jim Hornback's, and he'll foot the bill. And don't you fool around any, because he'll want to know the news. Tell him I'll have his niece all safe before he can get to town. Hump yourself now. I'm a-going up around the corner here to roust out my engineer. I struck for the light, but as soon as he turned the corner, I went back and got into my skiff and bailed her out, and then pulled up shore in the easy water about 600 yards and tucked myself in among some wood boats, for I couldn't rest easy till I could see the ferry boat start. But take it all around, I was feeling rather comfortable on account of taking all this trouble for that gang, for not many would have done it. I wish the widow knowed about it. I judge she would be proud of me for helping these rapscallions, because rapscallions and deadbeats is the kind the widow and good people takes the most interest in. Well, before long, here comes the wreck, dim and dusky, sliding along down. A kind of cold shiver went through me, and then I struck out for her. She was very deep, and I see in a minute there warn't much chance for anybody being alive in her. I pulled all around her and hollered a little, but there wasn't any answer. All dead still. I felt a little bit heavy-hearted about the gang, but not much, for I reckon if they could stand it, I could. Then here comes the ferry boat, so I shoved for the middle of the river on a long downstream slant, and when I judged I was out of eye reach, I laid on my oars and looked back and see her go and smell around the wreck for Miss Hooker's remainders, because the captain would know her Uncle Hornback would want them, and then pretty soon the ferry boat give it up and went for shore, and I laid into my work and went a-booming down the river. It did seem a powerful long time before Jim's light showed up, and when it did show, it looked like it was 1,000 mile off. By the time I got there, the sky was beginning to get a little gray in the east. So we struck for an island and hid the raft and sunk the skiff and turned in and slept like dead people. Chapter 14. By and by, when we got up, we turned over the truck the gang had stole off of the wreck and found boots and blankets and clothes and all sorts of other things, and a lot of books and a spyglass and 3 boxes of cigars. We had never been this rich before in neither of our lives. The cigars was prime. We laid off all the afternoon in the woods talking, and me reading the books and having a general good time. I told Jim all about what happened inside the wreck and at the ferry boat, and I said these kinds of things was adventures,
but he said he didn't want no more adventures. He said that when I went into Texas and he crawled back to get on the raft and found her gone, he nearly died, because he judged it was all up with him, any way it could be fixed. For if he didn't get saved, he would get drowned. And if he did get saved, whoever saved him would send him back home so as to get the reward, and then Miss Watson would sell him south, sure. Well, he was right. He was most always right. He had an uncommon level head for a nigger. I read considerable to Jim about kings and dukes and earls and such, and how gaudy they dressed, and how much style they put on, and call each other Your Majesty and Your Grace, and Your Lordship, and so on, instead of Mister. And Jim's eyes bugged out, and he was interested. He says,
"Well, I didn't know they was so many of 'em. I hain't heard about none of 'em, scarcely. But old King Solomon, unless you count them kings that's in a pack of cards, how much do a king get?"
"Get?" I says. "Why, they get $1,000 a month if they want it. They can have just as much as they want. Everything belongs to them."
"Ain't that gay? And what they got to do, Huck?"
"They don't do nothing."
"Why, how you talk? They just sit around." "No. Is that so?"
"Of course it is. They just sit around. Except maybe when there's a war. Then they go to the war. But other times they just lazy around or go hawking. Just hawking and..."
"Shh! Did you hear a noise?"
We skipped out and looked, but it weren't nothing but the flutter of a steamboat's wheel away down coming around the point, so we come back.
"Yes," says I, "and other times, when things is dull, they fuss with the Parliament, and if everybody don't go just so, he whacks their heads off. But mostly they hang around the harem."
"Round the which?"
"Harem."
"What's the harem?"
"The place where he keeps his wives. Don't you know about the harem? Solomon had one. He had about 1,000,000 wives."
"Why, yes, that's so. I done forgot it. A harem's a boarding house, I reckon. Most likely they had rackety times in the nursery. And I reckon the wives quarrels considerable. And that creased the racket. Yet they say Solomon the wisest man that ever lived. I don't take no stock in that. Because why? Would a wise man want to live in the midst of such a blim-blammin' all the time? No, indeed he wouldn't. A wise man would take and build a bottle factory, and then he could shut down the bottle factory when he want to rest."
"Well, but he was the wisest man anyway, because the widow, she told me so, her own self."
"I don't care what the widow say. He warn't no wise man nuther. He had some of the dad fetchedest ways I ever see. Does you know about that child that he is going to chop into?"
"Yes, the widow told me all about it."
"Well, then, weren't that the beatenest notion in the world? You just take and look at it a minute. That's the stump there. That's one of the women. Here's you. That's the other one. I'm Solomon, and this year dollar bill's the child. Both of you claims it. What does I do? Does I shin around amongst the neighbors and find out which of you the bill do belong to and hand it over to the right one, all safe and sound, the way to anybody that had any gumption would? No, I take and whack the bill in two and give half of it to you and the other half to the other woman. That's the way Solomon was going to do it with the child. Now I want to ask you, what's the use of that half a bill? Can't buy nothing with it. And what use is a half a child? I wouldn't have give a darn for 1,000,000 on 'em."
"But hang it, Jim, you've clean missed the point. Blame it, you've missed it 1,000 mile.
"Who, me? Go long. Don't talk to me about your pints. I reckon I knows sense when I sees it, and there ain't no sense in sich doings as that. Dispute warn't about half a child. Dispute was about a whole child, and the man that think he can settle a dispute about a whole child with a half child don't know enough to come in out of the rain. Don't talk to me about Solomon, Huck. I knows him by the back."
"But I tell you, you don't get the point."
"Blame the pint. I reckon I knows what I knows. And mind you, the real pint is down further. It's down deeper. It lays in the way Solomon was raised. You take a man that's got only one or two chillen, is that man going to be wasteful of chillen? No, he ain't. He can't afford it. He knows how to value them. But you take a man that's got about 5 million chillen running around the house, and it's different. He is soon chop a child in two as a cat. There's plenty more. A child or two, more or less, were no consequence to Solomon, dad fetch him.
I never see such a nigger. If he got a notion in his head once, there weren't no getting it out again. He was the most down on Solomon of any nigger I ever see. So I went to talking about other kings and let Solomon slide.